A warning. This podcast uses the sound of gunshots, live reports, firsthand accounts, and other sounds related to active shootings. If you need crisis counseling related to shootings, the National Disaster Distress Hotline is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can call 1-800-985-5990 or text 66746. If you know someone who may be a danger to the community or may be considering an act of violence yourself, please seek help. You can call your local authorities immediately. Many times you can be anonymous. Sandy Hook Promise also has a tip system called Say Something Tips. Just go to sandyhookpromise.org. It's Friday, December 13th, 2024. Yep, Friday the 13th. And I'm on the 30th floor of my office building in downtown Chicago. It's a magnificent lounge that overlooks Lake Michigan and Navy Pier. There's Christmas music playing overhead, and someone's playing pool in the open space behind me. I've been avoiding this moment for the last 3 days. In my backpack is the latest letter from Bobby Cremo. He responded again. This time I got more pointed questions into him. I didn't want to open this up in my office. There's a pit in my stomach, just like the previous jail letters I've received from mass shooters. I'm not looking forward to reading what's inside. This could go a few ways. Either he'll get real with me and answer my questions, which will probably disgust and disappoint me. He could tell me to piss off and stop writing him, which would pretty much end the conversation there. Or he'll play around with me and make a joke of this, leaving the door open for more conversations while making it easier to hate him. 5 days from now, I'll be back in a courtroom with him, about 50 feet away, for his latest status hearing. That is, if he decides to show this time. Speaking of which, I've got to apply for media credentials for that court hearing, and that'll stall me for another 2 minutes or so from having to open this envelope. It's weird. Sometimes I lie in bed unable to sleep because I'm thinking about these shootings. Who to talk to next? What was in the mind of these shooters? How have the survivors moved on? How many more books do I need to read? How many more producers do I need to reach out to talk about this topic? But with this unopened letter sitting in my bag, possibly unlocking the next chapter of this story, it's the last thing I want to read. I want to pause here because this is where things become a bit egocentric. I see a lot of people tuning out at this point. I never wanted to make this series about me. I actually wanted to do a standard journalism piece. Let the stories and the stats lead the way. My face is never seen. My voice is only narrating. I still want to do that. Nobody cares about a whining, complaining journalist. This is what you sign up for. This is the job. You get to cover some of the most impactful stories in the world. You get to travel the country. And then you complain about it. When I pitched this topic initially to producers, the feedback was always the same. Why are you the one who should be telling this story? What makes you unique? Can't anyone just slap together some news footage, some interviews, some stats, and do the narration? They actually suggested I rethink the approach, or at least lean into the things that make me the person to tell this story. Not just because I was there, not entirely. It's because these shootings had a direct impact on me, on my emotions, on my mindset. The psychologist said it was PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. It's something we tend to associate with veterans who return from war, but it's more frequently being diagnosed among general populations, including first responders and, yes, members of the media. My former WGN-TV colleague, Marcella Raymond, went public in 2019 with her own battle with PTSD. Hers was the result not only of reporting on violence in Chicago, but having to interact with grieving family members at crime scenes, even having to ask them for photos of children so she could put them into her stories. For me, it was more of a constant state of fight or flight. I'd go to bed at night thinking about the next one, where I'd be sent, when I'd be sent. There was no escaping it. It didn't matter where in the country it happened or what time, what I was doing, or where I was at. I was always on the clock. I had a jump bag at work, at home, and in my car, just in case I got a call. Probably about 3 to 4 days worth of stuff. And I'd have to rotate that based on whether it was warm or cold. I could get sent to Minnesota, I could get sent to Texas. And I want to point out, this isn't unique to me. This is the life of most of the national correspondents, photographers, and producers you see on TV or hear on the radio. Some are just better at handling it than others, or at least they seem to be. It was impacting my day-to-day life. In church, I would watch the exits, thinking about how protective the pews would be, how many steps to tackle someone if need be. I anxiously watched people at concerts, looking for any sign they had a gun, looked ill-tempered, or like they didn't fit in the crowd. I followed people with trench coats down the street to the point that I felt satisfied they weren't actually about to harm anyone. I looked for shadowy figures moving on rooftops. I talked way too much about mass shootings and social situations. But the funny thing is, when I'd get home from covering these events, I wasn't anxious to talk with my wife and two young children about what I'd been covering. And back at the office, I wanted to make it seem like I had it all under control. This was the job. This is what I signed up for. And I was pretty good at it. I'd never been trained on how to deal with this, how to separate my life from these horrible acts, only on the reporting itself. I've mentioned Las Vegas and Parkland and my time with ABC, but really this starts much earlier, in 2002, and the DC sniper shootings. My first job out of college was in Fredericksburg, Virginia, 22 years old, new communications degree, no real news experience that I didn't have a grade attached to. I was living on my own, 700 miles from friends and family, my girlfriend who would become my wife. I had a job in the field I studied for immediately out of college, the envy of all of my peers. But I was miserable. And then for 3 weeks in October, John Allen Muhammad and 17-year-old Lee Boyd Malvo terrorized the D.C. area, killing 10 people in sniper-style attacks, 17 if you include the previous shootings, and wounded another 10. It was a wild time to be there.
There's no way to estimate or guess where this person might hit again. All we can do is try to exercise caution.
Two of those shootings happened in the Fredericksburg area. On October 4th, 2002, Caroline Sewell was hit in the chest with a round as she innocently loaded her car with bags after shopping at a Michaels store at Spotsylvania Mall. She miraculously survived. This was just a few miles from my poorly furnished apartment and the same mall where I took on a part-time job to earn some extra cash. Immediately after the shooting, I-95 was completely shut down, helicopters overhead. This was the latest in a string of shootings over the two previous days, and the search was on for a white box truck. Of course, this was national news. My parents were calling me, looking for updates. My girlfriend, my former classmates. ABC News Radio called. As an affiliate, they wanted to know if I could work up a story for the network. Absolutely. This is the big time.
With the serial sniper still at large, area schools remain on high alert today. Stafford, Spotsylvania, King George, and Fredericksburg schools will keep students inside. All outdoor activities that can't be brought indoors will be canceled.
There were two more similar style shootings over the next week. So we did stories about sitting in your car and using your battery to better protect yourself. About zigzagging through parking lots to make yourself a more difficult target.
Donald Bassett, the now forensic consultant from Reedville, Virginia, who specializes in deadly force issues, says in case you hear shots,
I would recommend going toward the nearest cover or concealment.
Stores and gas stations were hiring semis to park on the outer edges of the lots to protect customers. Then on October 11th, around 9:30 in the morning, after anchoring a morning shift at WFVA and B101.5, I heard a scanner report of a person shot, maybe a sniper, at an Exxon station down the street. It was go time. I jumped in the car and was on the scene in a matter of minutes. I walked right up to the body lying there next to a gas pump before police pushed me back and put up crime scene tape. The person lying there on the ground was 53-year-old businessman Kenneth Bridges. He did not survive. I was one of the first reporters at the scene, but I wasn't going to be the last. I-95 was once again shut down in the false search for a white box truck. Helicopters flew overhead. Phone calls started coming in. By noon, every media outlet in the country was there. I saw Geraldo. There were later stories about him visiting with fans at the Hooters next door. It was a full-blown media circus, tents and all. I was doing reports, taking calls. This was before social media, so I was doing my best to keep all my friends and family up to speed. Each time, people would say, be careful, be safe. But as a 22-year-old, I was invincible. This was my calling. This is what I wanted to do. For the next decade of my life, as I job-hopped, moving up the media ladder to cities like Memphis, then back to Chicago, covering the D.C. sniper shootings would be prominently featured on my resume. It almost became a part of my work identity. I'd occasionally be invited to talk about it at my alma mater. It wasn't until years later that I even considered what my parents were worried about in those calls. I could have easily been in any of the sight lines of the stolen Bushmaster .223 caliber weapon tucked into the trunk of a hollowed-out 1990 Chevy Caprice. And there goes my ego again. Let's flash forward to November 5th, 2017.
We want to get you updated here on Facebook Live with the very latest information on the mass shooting during a church service in Sutherland Springs. We have learned new details about the shooter in the last 15 minutes.
26-year-old Devin Patrick Kelly of New Braunfels, Texas, arrived in a white SUV outside of Sutherland Springs First Baptist Church around 11 a.m. Sunday morning. Worship service had just gotten underway. Kelly was wearing tactical gear, a ballistic vest, and a black face mask. He was armed with a Ruger AR-556 semi-automatic rifle, a Glock 19 semi-automatic pistol, and a Ruger SR-22 semi-automatic pistol. All the weapons were possessed illegally following his domestic violence conviction in a court-martial while a member of the U.S. Air Force. However, the information was never entered into the FBI's National Crime Information Center database, which is used during background checks. With the Ruger AR-556 in hand, Kelly immediately opened fire on two people outside of the church, killing them both. He then proceeded to fire rounds directly at the church from outside before entering through the door. Once inside, witnesses heard him yell, "Everybody dies, MFers," as he methodically went up and down the rows of pews, shooting at people. 15 magazines were emptied, each containing 30 rounds. In an 11-minute span, 700 bullets were fired. All of the carnage is caught on security cameras at the church.
It was rapid fire. It was just boom, 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 boom. And you could hear that there was impact, and there was ricochet, too.
The daughter of Stephen Williford rushed into a room to tell her father she saw someone with a rifle and tactical gear enter First Baptist Church, and she heard gunshots. Williford, a former NRA instructor, grabbed his AR-15, loaded his magazine, and without shoes on, ran across the street to the church. He encountered Kelly and started shooting. The two engaged in a brief gunfight. Williford injured Kelly as he took cover behind a pickup truck. Kelly did manage to get into his vehicle and sped away. Williford then flagged down another pickup truck and told the driver, "That guy just shot up the Baptist church. We need to stop him." As Williford and the driver chased Kelly, Williford called 911. They eventually caught up to Kelly. Kelly's vehicle hit a road sign, then flipped into a ditch. Williford got out of his truck, aimed his rifle at the overturned vehicle, and demanded the gunman get out.
"I dropped my magazine and I looked. I got one in the top of the magazine, meaning I got one in the magazine, I got one in the chamber. I got two rounds left."
But there was no movement. Kelly had already shot himself in the head. Back at the church, 27 people were killed. 22 were hurt. Texas authorities said the shooting followed a domestic situation. At least one of the people in the church that day was Kelly's own relative. Now that Sunday, my parents agreed to take my two children. My wife and I were given two tickets to the Chicago Blackhawks suite through my work. There are a few benefits to working in the media. Though not a huge hockey fan, a date night opportunity with free food and parking seemed like a no-brainer. At the time, I was working as a dual reporter for WGN Radio and as Midwest correspondent for ABC News Radio. It was a job that entailed travel to political rallies, major sporting events, celebrity funerals, and the ever-increasing rise of mass shootings. It was a job that allowed me to be a part of historic events, but also required travel on a moment's notice. The mass shootings were wearing on me. 37-year-old husbands and fathers are not invincible. Emotions hit harder. Worries grow deeper. A month before, I had spent a week in Las Vegas reporting on the Route 91 Harvest Music Fest shooting. The gunman opened fire on unknown spectators perched from his hotel room on the 32nd floor of the Las Vegas Strip. 60 people were killed. Hundreds were hurt. A call woke me up at 3 in the morning Monday to catch the first plane to Vegas. If you're in the media, you can't stop the flow of emails. I appreciate the people who can detach, but in my role, at least the way I've seen it in my business, that's near impossible. And believe me, I've tried. Shout out to Kate Bowler and her book, How to Break Up with Your Phone. Back to Sutherland Springs, Texas, and the never-ending email string. First thing that pops up. Mass casualty event reported. Search for gunmen. Reports of 10, 15, 20 people shot.
We are about two blocks from the First Baptist Church, the scene of this deadly church shooting Sunday morning.
First press conference coming soon. First press conference delayed. Each new tidbit of information would create new terror in my mind.
We're here in Guadalupe County, where the sheriff here says this is where he believes that suspected gunman has died.
My hands went cold. My mind wandered. I couldn't focus. I couldn't eat. My brain was already in gymnastics mode. Maybe it's not so bad. Maybe these reports are wrong. Only three people dead? Only seven people dead?
This is where family members are gathering to find out if their loved ones were hurt in the shooting.
I would try to distract myself, mowing the lawn, watching a sporting event, trying to engage with my kids, but not really comprehending what they or I were even saying. My phone was buzzing constantly. My mind was on the shooting and the slow leak of information from the assignment desk.
We're able to see the back window broken out of a white SUV here. That is the vehicle that the alleged shooter was found in.
Part of it was feeling for the affected community, but selfishly, it was also my own worry that I was going to be sent to yet another horrific event. Spend the next week explaining that horrific event through stories and two ways with affiliate radio stations over and over again. It was just a matter of time before I got the call to jump on a plane. Relaxing wasn't an option. It was time to get into preparation mode. These gunmen were ruining my life, ruining my peace of mind. Why today? Why on our date night? When am I going to get this call? As my wife got ready for our rare date night, I laid on the floor of our bathroom, alone, hands clammy and shaking, looking up United Airlines flights to Texas, preparing for that moment when I was going to get the call. The emails kept coming, laying out the shooting spree, the body count, witness accounts.
It has been a chaotic scene even here. We are told that family members have been rushing in for the last couple hours. First it was the church, but then first responders moved them to this area.
I tried to absorb as much information as possible to be prepared for what was to come. But each new nugget would sink me deeper and deeper into a depressive state.
She doesn't even know if her loved one was shot or hurt in any way. All she knows was that her loved one, her grandmother, was here at this church this morning.
I cried. I couldn't process the sorrow of a church shooting. Hours after my family and I were just at our own church. The rising number of dead. The fact that I might have to grab my jump bag and go to that awful scene at any minute. Convinced I would end up in some unknown Texas town for at least a week, I finally told my wife about the shooting and chaotically planned for what me being gone would mean for her in the next week. Kids' practices, teachers' meetings, school pickups. Finally sputtering out the worries that had been bubbling up in my brain. How would we get our daughter to cheer practice Monday? Who would watch our son? What happens if I don't get a call? What happens if I get a call at the game? To this point, I had no directive that they were sending me. We did have a Texas reporter, but he was recently on another assignment. I wasn't about to reach out to the assignment desk myself to find out the status of the coverage. That would certainly lead to me being sent. So I worried. Worried about it all. Worried about schedules. Worried about what clothes to wear in Texas in November. I worried about the dinners my wife had planned out over the next week. I worried about the bills that needed to be paid over the next week. I worried about flights and hotels, mileage and reward points, expense reports and airport parking. I worried about backing out of the hockey tickets that were so rarely given out. Should I bring my jump bag to the game just in case I needed to leave from there? There was already one in the car. And also lingering in the back of my mind, what if a gunman like Kelly entered my church? What would I do? Would I lunge at him? Would my family be able to find the exits? Is anyone in my church armed? Until I got a call, all I could do was worry. My fingers ice cold, my hands shaking. My body was here, but my brain was in some unknown part of Texas. So I packed a bag, talked with my wife about plans. If I got called during the game, maybe I could just take a train to the airport and she could drive home. We ended up going to the game that night.
It's the final save of the hockey game, and Charlie Lindgren picks up his first National Hockey League shutout as the Montreal Canadiens beat the Blackhawks here tonight 2-0.
Besides a selfie my wife and I took that night, I don't remember a moment of it. All I remember is the worry. A call from the assignment desk never came, but my night was never normal. Call it trauma, call it anxiety, whatever you want.
It wasn't the first time I'd fallen into this spiral. It had been happening more and more frequently as these shootings were more frequent across the country. Weekends were the hardest because I was at home, chained to my cell phone. On April 22nd, 2018, I remember packing a bag, looking up flights, trying to get all my Saturday chores done as quickly as possible in case I got called to Nashville for the Waffle House shooting that left 4 dead and 4 hurt. It was a naked man that shot up the restaurant and ran away after being caught a day later.
Roughly 35 hours after Ryan King allegedly killed 4 and wounded several others, her call helped authorities track him to a wooded area outside his home.
A month later, I remember my hands going so cold I couldn't type, fearing I'd get sent to a school shooting in Indiana where one teacher actually stopped a gunman.
One teacher who, sources say, stepped in to protect the students was shot. Another student, a female, also shot.
On August 27, 2018, I remember struggling to mow the lawn while getting constant updates on a shooting at an esports tournament in Tampa, Florida, fearing that I'd be sent there.
The first gunshot sounded like a balloon pop, and then second, third, and fourth one, we just seen like everybody moving quickly to the front to the exit.
By the way, I wasn't sent to any of these. Mentally, I was there, though, feeling it all, the pain, the stress, the nervousness. It turns out worry doesn't solve anything. Preparing isn't bad, but when worry becomes all-consuming, when you feed your brain with all the what-ifs, it can send you down a dark path. And the funny thing is, when I was covering the story, when I was there actually at the scene, I was fine. It was the waiting. It was the not knowing. I decided the morning after the Sutherland Springs shooting I needed to seek professional help to help me process all this fear, worry, and pain. By the way, ABC did call the next day and asked me if I could go to Texas. I declined. And that began a more structured journey in covering these events in the years to come. So there's my egocentric pitch to you as to why I should be the vessel to this story on mass shootings in America. Over 23 years, and somehow I actually turned myself into a victim. And the true reason for this podcast, I think I'm not the only one. So let's go back to now, December 2024. I just applied for the jury box seat. Hopefully in the next week, I'll know if I'm in. I guess the only thing left to do is open up this letter. Yeah, he's an asshole. This is Interrupting Mass Shootings, Chapter 1, Part 2, The Aftermath. A minute of mass shooting data from the Violence Project. 28% of mass shootings are workplace shootings. That's more than school, places of worship, and public spaces. 63% of shooters had a previous violent history. Studies show girls who have had childhood trauma are more likely to suffer anxiety and depression. Boys who suffer from a childhood trauma are more likely to project their feelings outward through aggression, hostility, and delinquency. 70% of school mass shooters had a history of childhood trauma. Gunmen with childhood trauma kill significantly more people than shooters without trauma. 90% of school shooters are current students or were former students at the school. School safety is a $3 billion industry, yet there's no evidence that hardening schools has led to fewer shootings. Continue to look into the aftermath and impact of these shootings. I want to look deeper into trauma care and what effort is needed to return victims, their families, and the community to some kind of normalcy. Stephanie Chinqua is a social worker from Sandy Hook, Connecticut. Prior to the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary, she provided trauma-informed crisis counseling for jail populations. But after the shooting in 2012, her focus and efforts changed. She's now the founder of the Resiliency Center of Newtown.
So shortly after the Sandy Hook school shooting, I felt really compelled to help my community. I lived there with my kids, a first grader and a preschooler. Fortunately, my children were in the private school there, but I did have friends whose kids were murdered, and kids were there. And so I was seeing the impact in the community. I said, I really need to do something to help us heal and bring the community together. So after a few months, I opened the Resiliency Center of Newtown to not duplicate services that were already provided in organizations that were there prior to the shooting, but non-traditional modalities, as well as a place for people to gather and heal, because what we know is relationships heal people. And so that connection became a safe space to come to the center. And over time, if you then needed additional support, you could go see a mental health clinician, but you did not need to have an appointment. You could just come there and work and hang out and feel connected.
When you look back on those months and years after, what is your takeaway? What were some of the deficiencies and what were some of the successes?
So I think a deficiency, and this still happens, unfortunately, in communities across the country, we think we're prepared, but we're never truly prepared. So we are a small community. So fortunately, unlike other events where those injured and those lost are all over the country, we were all in a place that we could provide supports. But communication, I think, was one of our downfalls just as a whole. We know when people have trauma, you could say things 10 ways, 10 different ways, and they may not always hear it or interpret it properly. And so that was difficult because, you know, that's part of unintended consequences, right? You want to do something. There were a lot of supports and services, but not everybody who needed them knew about them.
You had been in this industry prior to the shooting, correct, with trauma-informed care?
Correct, but in the prison setting. So I was working for the public defender's office in New York, legal aid in New York, public defenders in Connecticut, doing mitigation for sentencing of defendants. So that trauma-informed approach of really what happened to you versus why do bad people do bad things. I am a true believer, and I'm a social worker, that there's no such thing as a bad person.
In this process, have you talked to a shooter or someone who was considering or perhaps got arrested prior to one of these shootings? They're trying to, I mean, to, for lack of a better term, pick their brain and understand kind of what sets them off and why they decide to go down this route?
So I actually have spoken to Aaron Stark, his TED Talks, I was almost a school shooter, and I've actually presented with him. And, you know, very fit to what we know about school shooter, right? He was bullied, came from a horrible family situation. So we would say a very high ACEs score. So he had a tremendous amount of risk factors, then bullied, then moved schools a lot, didn't get the supports and services he needed for a variety of reasons, all out of his control as a child. But at the end of it, was able to have a trusted companion who talked him out of it.
Is there a difference between, you talked about prisons, someone who needs care resulting from a mass shooting versus a car crash or some kind of jail situation or a fire? I mean, is there a difference that you've noticed, or is trauma trauma?
So I think that goes more PTSD could look very different from somebody who is in a car accident versus a shooter. So I wouldn't blanket it. However, I will say how our brain is impacted by trauma is the same for everyone across all colors, races, age, right? Trauma is stored in the subconscious. In our brain, we function from the bottom up. And if we're always in our brainstem because of trauma, we're very dysregulated, that flight, freeze, versus being in our cortex where we can make better decisions, more regulated.
Do you find, and maybe we're still too early in this and the research in it, I know we've seen kind of in the past that people who were the victims of sex abuse can perhaps lead them to become abusers in the future. Are we nervous that that is the case with these shooters, especially with more and more victims coming up across the country?
So there is no research to state that. We know roughly 20% of people who are in a school shooting or a mass shooting will end up with PTSD. You know, we don't, I mean, the Sandy Hook kids, look at them. They were 6, 7. They're now 18, 19, right? So we're just learning. Are they able to graduate and successfully launch into college or employment? And what does that look like? We do know towns with a school shooting sometimes have a second school shooting, which happened in Columbine.
If someone were to have trauma as a result of a car crash, that was their car crash. So that doesn't impact me. But if I am either a witness to a school shooting, know someone who is in a school shooting, or even watch media coverage of a school shooting, I feel like it's broader. I feel like the trauma spreads out further with this than maybe some kind of individualized event.
Correct. This is much scarier to people. I mean, first of all, you have that whole perceived threat is as real as a real threat. So if you maybe watch the news over and over again, and we'll just use the example of Sandy Hook, and you have a first grader, you might end up taking on some of that trauma, right, from the newsreels. That's why we always say after another event, which unfortunately they are, or like the trial coming up, stay off social media, don't watch the news, because that's a real thing.
From outside looking in, especially for the people who weren't involved in it, like, you weren't a part of it. You weren't there. Why are you seeing this trauma? And I kind of equate it back to 9/11, when all of the people were freaked out about going on airplanes or wondering where terrorists were. It just kind of spreads. And I don't know how you approach people and talk to people who maybe feel that guilt or that anxiety, even though they weren't actually in that situation.
So that survivor's guilt is definitely something that we work through, right? You're just entitled to services and support as somebody else. And if you're feeling you need services, as I always say, people aren't going to fake needing mental health support. Let's try to support them and give it to them. I mean, we work closely with 9/11 families. And so it was their way to give back in Sandy Hook. Mostly kids who lost a parent in 9/11. And it was great and really healing for them. But now that they're getting married and having kids, sometimes difficult for them.
What do we in the media do wrong in these situations? I've talked to some survivors, some victims. I obviously know about the pressures they feel when there are all of a sudden cameras and microphones shoved in their face. Obviously, it's been well documented in Newtown with, you know, some of the issues that they had there with the media and the coverage. Is there something when you sit back, if there was hypothetically a shooting today and you were watching news, cable news channel, and watching the coverage, is there something that you see that is a problem, the way we handle it, the way we talk about these shootings?
I feel like they become sensationalized, right? And then they're all over the media, and then oftentimes we'll have a copycat or a threat shortly after a school shooting. And there's probably a variety of reasons for that. I also had struggled, and I did in Newtown a lot when reporters wanted to come into the center. I never let a reporter into the center because I really believed that those most impacted weren't, right, they weren't functioning in the high level of the brain where I need them to be to make a really sound choice. They were very dysregulated. And when we have children or adults going on to the news, they don't really understand sometimes what that means or how that looks, and it never goes away. So really making sure victims are healed and doing the work before we, you know, put them on the news and have them speaking.
The easiest thing for us, you want to get the victim, right? You're looking for sound. Right. You're looking for someone to talk to. And, you know, a lot of them are, they almost look shell-shocked when you're talking to them, right? They haven't even processed what it is. I mean, they'll describe what they saw. And I think
there's probably regret after the fact by both sides. The answers that were given and the questions that were asked, but you know, you're trying to meet deadlines and trying to get that information out as quick as possible. And you don't know if you're ever going to see these people again. So, it's kind of an awkward dance and an awkward balance. I don't know if we're getting any better at it in the media. I mean, I almost wish that sometimes in these shootings, it's almost better when it's in a remote location that we can't get to in a hurry versus, right, you know, a place in an urban area where there's a lot of media and a lot of cameras, because even though you're getting raw emotions, that may not be good for the people who are giving those interviews and the people.
Right.
Seeing
that's
it
just serving
it.
The media, right? Versus sure. Really serving the individual who, again, is dysregulated in the lower part of the brain, not making the most sound decisions. And sure. They can't. They physically can't. They don't know that. They don't understand that.
Have you worked with the Sandy Hook Promise? I know they've been very active.
So I consult with them. And so after a shooting response, we work together to help with that resiliency and recovery piece post a tragedy.
Who would have thought that this would become an industry, essentially because of how many there have been. Tell me a little bit. You were in Chicago yesterday, or the Chicago area. You were meeting with officials from Highland Park. Can you talk a little bit about what you were?
Yeah, so actually I was not there for that. I was doing work with Sandy Hook Promise, working on this response. But I spoke to Highland Park a couple weeks ago, because now most places that have a mass shooting get a resiliency center. So she was talking to me about how it looked in Newtown, what we've done, what we're seeing. The resiliency center in Highland Park, you know, again, not everyone was necessarily local. She still has one or two staff. And really talking about, you know, the trials coming up, what does that look like? We didn't have that in Newtown, but other communities have. And how do you support the victims and survivors as this approaches?
Yeah, that's an interesting angle to this. In Parkland, obviously, there was a trial. I mean, is there obviously stands an opportunity here for some of these people to be essentially re-traumatized by what happened after 3 years. Having spoken with some of the city officials there, you want to show people you're there, but you don't necessarily want to broadcast to the world and potentially right. Freak people out even more, right?
Right. And like in every event, not all of the victims and survivors are coming from the same place. So this isn't a blanket answer. And so really supporting everyone where they're at individually, you know, something like a trial. I do work also with Boston bombing survivors is you make sure we have a self-care plan for each individual. If they're going to participate, and some people will choose not to come to the trial, but if they're choosing to come, make sure you take them there ahead of time, not the day of. So they can see the room, they can see the space, they can get familiar with the courthouse, because they're going to be coming in there, again, very dysregulated. And so how do we support them? Making sure we have mental health services and referrals available or people available to them. You know, they'll all have a victim assistance person or advocate, but what other supports are in place who are re-traumatized, or maybe people for the first time realizing I'm not as well, quote unquote, you know, as I thought I was, and maybe it's time for me to seek some help.
Are there little unique things about each of these situations? Like when you approach them, do you approach them the same way? Or do you know that Highland Park is different than Sandy Hook, is different than Parkland, is different than Las Vegas?
They're all very different, right? What we do know is how trauma impacts the brain, and that's the same. But what we have to be very careful and mindful of, every community has to do what works for them, and that needs to be organic. So what worked really well for us in Newtown may not work well, like in Uvalde, where Uvalde or in Maine had a workforce issue, had transportation issues, you know. So how do we still accommodate the needs with what the community is working with.
Is it difficult, having all the information, all the experience you've dealt with, to not be a so-called ambulance chaser in these situations, not to rush in to these communities? Do you let them come to you? Is the contact made?
I call, it's funny you use that word, because I call them the ambulance chasers of trauma. And they're no doubt everywhere. So I always tell people, like, the people who show up and knock on your door are the ones who want to write a book and to sensationalize this or write a documentary. If that doesn't serve your community or, more importantly, the most impacted individuals. So, you know, we can support from the outside, but I also say it needs to be organic. It needs to be, you know, I was in Nashville for Covenant recently. It needs to be your people. I can help guide you now that you're ready, but it has to be organic. I can't tell you what works there. And, you know, at the center, like I said, I didn't let anybody in. They wanted to do a documentary. I said no. And I tell other centers, you need to make sure that your team isn't there to write a book and then become an ambulance chaser of trauma. We have learned valuable information that needs to be shared. But again, more of a, as an assistance to help guide the process.
Is there anything that you feel, and I'll wrap it up with this, is there anything that you feel you've learned about these kind of shootings over the years that maybe isn't out there publicly, ways to prevent them?
Shootings are all preventable, you know that. And so as we work towards identifying that, such things as what we work with the Sandy Hook Promise, right? Making sure every student has a trusted adult, making sure students feel a sense of belonging when they're at school, making sure kids feel comfortable saying something to a trusted adult. We know peers are the most influential at that age, and most school shooters have posted on social media before they were going to make an attempt. So training students and youth on what that looks like to report it.
Yeah, that's probably the hardest thing, right? Trying to, when people might say, hey, that guy's weird or that person's just strange, but actually doing something about it,
right.
That's getting over that hump has been probably the biggest challenge.
Yeah, and teaching empathy. Empathy is a learned skill. So as a society, making sure we're teaching empathy. In order to be resilient, you have to have overcome adversity.
It's weird to tell a community, though, that you weren't an empathetic community, you know, that it's your fault because this person slipped through the cracks. It's a challenge.
It's so much more complicated than that, right?
It is.
It's not a one person pointing the finger. It's your fault. Systemically, it's a much larger issue than that.
Is there a website people can go to find out more information or ways that they can maybe reach out to you?
Yeah, so they can go to the Resiliency Center of Newtown website. And if they're looking for, if it's a community looking for, you know, upstream violence prevention programming, they can go to Sandy Hook Promise.
There are resources available to victims and their families offered by the American Red Cross, the U.S. Department of Justice, the National Mass Violence Victimization Resource Center, and the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. Interrupting the next mass shooting. You're trying to find out what went wrong, where it went wrong, and I assume that's kind of where you pursue as far as litigation goes, whether it be the gun manufacturers, red flag laws, perhaps security, parents in some cases.
Our long-term goal is to stop this from happening again. And so far, you can see we have not done our job, right? Whether it's government or lawyers, we have not adequately done the job to say this will never happen again.